Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Just a few minutes ago, I had the opportunity to visit with the presidents of the state presidents of the farm bureaus represented here today.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack at the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention.
And I shared with them our commitment to expanding crop insurance, looking at currently 134 crops that are insured through risk management. That's increased dramatically. 604 varieties are covered, 34 plans, $207 billion in production is protected through this mechanism. Last year, we invested about $12 billion in indemnity. The year before, $19 billion. These are life-saving payments that are required and necessary in order for us to continue to conserve the opportunity to farm.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think it creates, for me, as the Secretary of Agriculture, and for all of you, a sacred responsibility focused on conserving.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack speaking at the annual convention for Farm Bureau in Salt Lake City.
First of all, conserving those natural resources, and that's why it's important for us to continue to work collaboratively together in partnership to utilize the resources that are now available under the Inflation Reduction Act that expand dramatically the amount of resource and support for conservation. And I know that farmers and ranchers and producers are taking advantage of this because the programs are oversubscribed. The demand is great. We want to continue to work to use those resources in a way that allows you to enrich the soil, to improve water quality, to conserve those resources. I think it's important and a sacred responsibility on our part to ensure that we conserve the opportunity to continue to farm, notwithstanding the fact that farmers, ranchers, and producers across the country are often faced with disasters. We know that we've seen a marked increase in the intensity of those disasters. The 100-year flood doesn't occur every 100 years. Unfortunately and tragically, in some parts of the country, they occur 100 days apart. And so it's important for us to continue to focus on risk management, on crop insurance, to ensure that we, in fact, can provide the assistance and help.
He outlines how consolidation has really hit rural areas harder than any other part of the country.
On my desk, there's also a book that was written in 1863. It was the first report of the Commissioner of Agriculture for the United States. It was a report to Abraham Lincoln. Thankfully, I don't have to do that with President Biden. Good Lord. This report was 632 pages long. It was remarkable. But in it was a preface about the importance of preserving the opportunity for small and mid-sized farming operations as central to our democracy. And a warning that if we allow the erosion of small and mid-sized operations, that our democracy, our country would suffer. Fast forward to 1981. A predecessor of mine, Secretary Berglund from Minnesota, expressed the same concern. As we watched the transition from a supply management system where farmers did pretty well during the post-depression era to a supply management, to a market system, the concern was that this would drive further consolidation of farmland. Since 1981, since Bob Berglund issued that warning, we've lost 437,300 farms. Now, that's farm families that are no longer in the farming business, which means that in all likelihood their families are no longer in those small communities, which means their children aren't in school, which is one of the reasons why schools have had to consolidate. They're not shopping at the central business district, which means that small family-owned business may not be in business today. It may be a dollar store or Walmart. It means that the local hospital maybe is now a clinic. And the question I ask all of you today is whether we're okay with that. In a 40-year period, the loss of that many farms, to give you a sense of how many farmers that is, that's every farmer today in North Dakota and South Dakota, in Wisconsin and Minnesota, in Iowa and Illinois, Nebraska and Colorado. At the same time, since 1981, we've lost 141 million acres of farm land. Land that was once in farming that isn't farming today. That's the landmass of Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Maryland. Are we okay with that?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
All right, I'm from West Central Georgia. I live about an hour south of Atlanta.
Matt Bottoms is a Georgia producer and member of the Georgia Farm Bureau.
And we grow small fruit-bearing plants and kind of ship all over the southeast primarily, but plants like blueberries, blackberries, raspberries. For the ones in the south, we grow muscadines. A lot of people may not know what that is, but that's one of our main crops. And then we have a small row crop operation as well.
And based upon his operation, what's the biggest challenge he's facing today?
Right now, for us, and I think many specialty crop producers that require a lot of hand labor, labor is the issue. There's not a strong pool of Americans to draw from who want to work outside in the elements, and so we are constantly struggling to try to find people, and sometimes the visa programs are not the easiest to navigate, and so for us that's the biggest issue right now is probably labor.
And Congress at this point is aware there's problems with the H-2A program, but how could they improve it?
There are a lot of things about the program that need to be addressed, and probably one of the hardest things for us the last 2 years is our labor rates have increased almost $3 an hour in less than 2 years. You know, trying to balance that with being able to properly price a product. I mean, if we can't operate at a profit, we'll go out of business soon. And when we really don't understand how that adverse effect wage rate is calculated, it's hard to go into a year planning and properly budgeting to be successful. And so that's one of the first things that I believe needs to be addressed, because the producer is not able to properly prepare for the wage rates that come down the pipe.
Talks about how their prices are set.
In the nursery business, and for us, you know, we're able to really look at all of our inputs and be able to really put a pencil to what it is costing us to produce that product, and then try to figure a fair profit margin in on that. And so we are able to price a product more similar to a traditional retail market versus the whims of the Board of Trade, if you will, or what weather event is happening in Brazil or whatever. So we get to taste a little bit of both of those worlds because our operation is split in it. But in the specialty crops, a lot of times we have a little bit more power to control our pricing. But again, it's hard to do that when you don't. Labor is our biggest input cost. Hands down, labor is our biggest input cost. And when that goes up a tremendous percentage, you know, when you've already set prices for the year and it jumps, it's hard to budget for that so that you can keep your profit margins in line.
But with all the challenges that exist with labor, is there another alternative?
You know, there are different companies that are experimenting with robotics and different things like that. And some of those things are maybe out of the price range for the small producer. But it does give the opportunity through various things to have opportunity for growth and expansion.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We're just seeing with the redistricting, our rural areas have had to expand, and our rural members and take in population from, a lot of them run from there on the High Plains, ran all the way over into the western part of Fort Worth, northern part of Dallas.
David Gibson, executive director of the Texas Corn Producers, says we need to be watching something in every state.
Our Central Texas legislators that represent a large part of our rural area wind up with seats that stretch into Austin or get a lot of the growth out of Dallas, north and south. And it's going to be a real challenge if our rural voters don't get out and look at these candidates and go vote, we're certainly liable to see a lot of change in the folks that win elections and the type of knowledge they have, the interest they have in rural agricultural land, rural water issues, rural health issues, just the whole thing from out for all of us that live like you and all of our growers scattered wherever they are in the state that don't live in one of those metropolitan areas. So hearing the candidates that we've been listening to, we have some very inexperienced agricultural-based candidates running for a lot of those seats. And then there are some that you spend a little time talking to them, asking them questions. You can find out the ones that have a lot more of our rural interest, you know, is close and near to their heart because they've lived it. They've been ag producers. They've been small business owners and out in their rural communities. And I really encourage folks up in rural America, rural Texas, to be sure and examine those candidates, get to know them, ask questions, and see exactly what they're standing for, and then go vote. That's going to be very important, is to get the vote out in these primary elections coming up in March. So I really encourage all our producers. We're going to be sending things to our members, encouraging them to meet these candidates as they come around to your communities. Ask them questions about issues that's important right here at home, and then follow up with going to vote whenever we have that primary. We'll do the primary and turn around and have the general election in November. But a lot of our House members, both state and federal, get elected in the primaries because we'll only have races in one party. So being prepared and just not passing over the primary is going to be very important this year in Texas. And I think we could say that's going to be true for all of our states that have a lot of rural interests that have spread districts to where they're got a high urban influence. Not to say our urban friends aren't good, but they really don't understand the issues with health care in our small communities. They don't understand our water issues. There's multiple things, our broadband issues, things that we deal with out in rural Texas.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I don't think the country can stand a continued acceleration of the loss of small and mid-sized farming operations. We can do better.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack was in Salt Lake City for the annual convention for Farm Bureau.
We can figure out ways in which large production agriculture can continue to flourish as it is important and necessary to meet the food demands not just of the U.S., but of the world. But at the same time, we can also provide an entrepreneurial opportunity for that small and mid-sized operation. What am I talking about? Well, Zippy mentioned the sustainability practices that Farm Bureau and a number of farm organizations came to USDA and suggested that if we could set up a voluntary, incentive-based, market-driven system, farmers would respond. And boy, was he right about that. Now, 141 projects are now engaged in 50 states, involving well over 100 major commodities, involving 205 sustainability practices. Farmers are now going to be paid, encouraged, incented, rewarded for taking those steps to be more sustainable, and we're going to work with the market forces to create a value-added opportunity. But the great opportunity in the sustainable area isn't just a value-added opportunity, isn't just farmers being rewarded for being good stewards of the land. It's also the ability to measure and monitor and verify the results of those practices and be able to utilize them in creating market opportunities through carbon markets and other environmental markets that are designed for farmers, creating a whole new source of income for farming operations. At the same time, there are projects like GEVO, which is operating out of the upper Midwest, that is focused on taking agricultural waste and turning it into sustainable aviation fuel. This is a whole new opportunity for American agriculture to embrace our transportation challenges. While we're getting to net zero, we're going to help the transportation industry get to net zero. It's a 36-billion-gallon industry that doesn't exist today, that can create nearly a million jobs in rural places, that can create more opportunity, more sustainable economic opportunity for small and mid-sized operations.
He also addressed the increased input cost and says USDA is adding opportunities.
We're excited about this future. We're excited about lowering costs for farmers. We know that input costs are a deep concern. That's why we continue to see an expansion of our Renewable Energy for America program, helping individual farming operations lower their energy costs by installing on their farm individualized renewable energy projects. Today, we're announcing an expansion of opportunity in that space. Excited about that opportunity. We're announcing 650 additional projects being awarded in 42 states, about $150 million to expand that opportunity. It's going to help lower costs for farmers all across the United States. We've already done over 4,800 of those awards, and we're going to continue to see a significant increase. But it's not just lowering the cost that this creates. It also creates the opportunity as farmers improve renewable energy opportunities and increase the amount of energy that's produced on their farm. They can take that excess energy and, working with their neighbors, potentially work with their REC to create power purchasing agreements and yet another income source that doesn't exist today that will exist in the future.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, the committee at the national level, we're just here to help promote and educate people about agriculture, mainly adult consumer engagement.
Alan Clark is a producer from Idaho and chairman of Farm Bureau's Promotion and Education Committee.
We're helping our farmers be able to tell their agriculture stories to the general public, the people that are using our products, and we're trying to bridge that information gap that has come about by people being two to three generations removed from agriculture, and, you know, continue to build that trust between the farmers and what we're doing on a day-to-day basis to the consumers that, you know, today they're super interested in where their food comes from. And so we're just trying to help the farmers provide that message for them.
And talks about some of the challenges.
One of the main challenges is, you know, farmers, they like to farm. They like to put all their energy into farming. And so to be able to get a farmer to get out of their tractor or off their horse to go out and share that story, that's a hard story because we are dedicated workers and we like doing what we do. So the thought of maybe going out and talking to the general public about what we're doing, it's either scary or it hasn't even crossed their mind. And on the other side, the consumer, like I said, is so far removed from farmers, they might not know where to find a farmer. And so we're trying to make it so that farmers are a little more easily accessed.
And social media?
That has been a great channel. I mean, we like to share what we're doing. We're proud of farming and ranching. But, you know, we try to help when people share their story, share what they're doing and why they're doing it. So when we're out there roping our calves and doctoring them and have a picture of them tied up, that they're like, oh, they're hurting that animal. But in all reality, we're helping them so that they can continue to grow, to survive, to be live a happy life.
But sometimes it can become an echo chamber.
I understand, you know, preaching to the choir, and sometimes it can be hard. But I think it's those conversations that we can have in the grocery store. When someone's walking through the grocery store and they're trying to decide, you know, GMO, non-GMO, organic, you know, those are all great practices, but they're struggling with that decision, and maybe just stepping up and saying, hey, you know, I grow that fruit. You know, do you have any questions? And starting that conversation there and building that trust. I have a quick story. I used to run Spartan races, and I'd be out and talking to people. And I talked to some people from California, and I told them I was a farmer. And they're like, oh, man, you're killing us with pesticides. And I went out and I said, not really. And I explained to him that we're only putting like 20 ounces, like a pop bottle worth of chemical out onto a football field. And they're just like, oh, that's not what it looks like. But if that's what it is, you know, I built that trust with them. You know, they had that connection. And what was interesting, they went and they told a lot of their friends, and they all started following me on social media. And so now I have like 20, 30 people from, I think it's San Francisco, that follow me. And when they have questions, they reach out to me because I built that trust with them. And I think if farmers and ranchers can do that, you know, just open that story, be willing to have the conversation in everyday settings, and then utilize social media, or, I mean, it's just going to be a great experience.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
In August of 2022, Congress passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which included a whole host of new clean energy policies meant to reduce carbon, address climate change, etc.
Kurt Kavarik is with Clean Fuels Alliance America, formerly known as the National Biodiesel Board.
One of those was a new tax incentive for the production and use of sustainable aviation fuel. And again, enacted in August of 2022, this tax incentive was available for 2023 and 2024. IRS has yet to basically put out the guidance on how to claim this credit. And you hit on a very important point of it. This is the first time, in my knowledge, that IRS has been tasked to implement a tax incentive based on carbon intensity. So Congress said, we're going to provide this tax incentive, and if you can prove that your fuel is a certain percentage less carbon emitting than petroleum jet fuel, you get this value of a credit, and that credit goes up based on how much cleaner you are compared to petroleum. The complicating factor here is we have some environmentalists and others who are pursuing a carbon model to score the fuels that's based on outdated data. It's a UN model that, in our view, arbitrarily penalizes crop-based biofuels. And what we're advocating for is the use of a model, as you said, called the GREET model, put together by the Argonne National Laboratory, a Department of Energy laboratory that sits just outside of Chicago, Illinois, that we view is the gold standard for calculating all of the direct emissions and the indirect emissions from biofuels. So we have folks coming to Washington tomorrow, starting tonight, for about 60 meetings on the Hill and about a half a dozen or so with the administration, not trying to necessarily put our finger on the scale of the science, but just to advocate for the use of science. You know, our problem arises when the models are manipulated in one fashion or another to try to tip the scales to arbitrarily penalize crop-based biofuels. And Tony, imagine if Congress were to create and IRS were to implement a tax incentive that uses a European UN-based model that disqualifies our own American farmers and their feedstock from qualifying for this tax incentive. It's a perverse scenario that only the most extreme environmentalists could pursue. That's our message to the administration and to Congress this week. They've got a deadline of March 1st to update the modeling and convey to sustainable aviation fuel producers how this credit's going to work. Our message is, as long as it's based on sound science that we all agree on, the U.S. government Argonne National Laboratory model, then we don't take any issue with this. And we would hope that they don't manipulate this in a manner to penalize arbitrarily based on so-called indirect land use changes of crop-based biofuels to the point that U.S. Farmers can't even qualify.
And a couple of big meetings coming up.
We'll be in Houston for Commodity Classic at the very end of February. On Thursday, the 29th, Clean Fuels will be hosting a learning session to talk directly to farmers about the value that our industry, the biomass-based diesel industry, has brought to the soybean farmer, and to talk about new opportunities in winter annual crops that could be better for sustainability as well as oil producing that we could use as an additional feedstock. So two great opportunities to engage with us and our industry in Fort Worth and then again at the Commodity Classic in Houston.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think at the foundation of our economy and our value system is American agriculture. The farmers and ranchers and producers across this great country that work hard every single day to provide extraordinary diversity of product.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack was in Salt Lake City addressing members of the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention.
I think it's important for us to recognize as a country the incredible contribution that is made by farmers and ranchers and producers that indeed makes our country the strongest and most powerful in the world, one that's food secure, one that creates opportunities for the rest of America to do what it does because it doesn't have to worry about having to feed our family. We just simply have to have a paycheck allowing us to go to a grocery store and get the benefit of your hard work.